Hi, I'm Allison Kulo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
With the work landscape continuing to evolve, executives and high-potential employees today need every bit of help in becoming the best leaders possible. If you ask someone about their best boss, most people will usually single out just one person who meets their definition, says Duncan Ferguson. In doing so, this makes great leadership something unexpected. Our goal in writing this book is to make having a great boss the rule and not the exception.
Duncan Ferguson is the co-author of Best Boss, The Impact of Extraordinary Leaders. Embedded in a model containing five dimensions, the Best Boss approach presents a self-reinforcing and self-sustaining system of interaction built upon a foundation of mutual trust and respect. Moving beyond the individual leader, the work concludes by examining various factors, some obvious and some not, that help explain the rare occurrence of a best boss. Duncan Ferguson has an extensive background in both corporate human resources, having held senior leadership roles at BP Amoco and GATX. I don't know what that is, but he can tell us, corporation, and organizational and leadership consulting at BPI Group. Ferguson is a senior consultant at Vantage Leadership Consulting, where he provides leadership, development, coaching, and counsel. Duncan, thank you for joining us this morning.
Well, thanks very much to both of you for having me. I'm really looking forward to it.
So let's just start. You know, what motivated you to write the book, and how long did it take you to write it?
That's a good question. You read about my background a little bit, and for the longest time, I've been interested in leadership and what makes leadership great. I was a leader myself in my two corporate organizations, and then I worked with a lot of leaders in my consulting days. And that was always just intriguing me, what brings out the best in people. And frankly, there was a conversation I had a little while ago with a friend when I asked him, we were having lunch and just talking about stuff. And I asked him, I said, so tell me about your job. How you doing and, you know, what's going on? And I kind of expected the normal response you get, which is, it's okay, it's fine, blah, blah, blah. Maybe I'm going to be looking for a new job. And he surprised me. He said, this is the best job I've ever had in my life. And that stopped me in my tracks because you don't hear people say that very much. And he went on to say, it's because of my boss. This person's the best person I've ever worked for in my life. And then he went on to describe these tremendous attributes that his boss had. And when he concluded, he said another question that just, again, stopped me. He said, the only problem with this is I don't think I'll be able to work with anybody else ever again in my life because this experience has been so great. And that's what really stopped me. And you mentioned in the introduction that so often in times, we best bosses or great leaders in our lives are the exception, not the rule. Excuse me. So I decided to say, let's take a look and see why can't this be the rule and the exception. And I should say my co-authors, Tony Pristo and John Furcon, the three of us decided to take a look at best boss experiences because that question seems so powerful when you ask it to people. The book took about, I'd say, 5 or 6 months to write. It's been percolating in our minds for a little while. I must admit, having the pandemic and slowing things down work-wise gave us some time to really focus and think about what we wanted to say, how we wanted to say it, and just take the time and discipline to writing it.
You start the book with an anecdote about a character called Courtney. Can you share a little of that anecdote with the audience, and then tell us why you thought that set the tone for the rest of the book?
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for talking about the Courtney story. Courtney was a former colleague and coworker. She completed our online survey a little bit later than the rest of the survey responses had happened. And when I read it, I was just kind of blown away by the power of the story. For those who have not seen the book yet, the story basically is about Courtney. When I asked her to fill out the survey, she thought immediately about the first boss that she had in her life, a fellow by the name of Bob. And she realized in answering our questions what a remarkable person Bob was and what a tremendous impact that he had on her career and really her life. But she hadn't talked to him in a while. Her career had moved on to different places and whatever. So she decided after several years to reach out to Bob and tell him what a great boss he was. And she found out, much to her surprise and chagrin, that that Bob had a terminal illness, and she couldn't see him, but she could write a letter to him describing what an important person that Bob was in her life. And he had a chance to listen to it. She gave the letter to Bob's wife, who read it to him in the hospital. They even used excerpts of Courtney's letter to Bob at the funeral services. And anytime I shared that story with anybody, it had everything that we saw in the Best Boss study. It had the elements of what a Best Boss is and what they look like and what a difference they make, not only as a worker and employee, but certainly as a person. And it was powerful. I haven't told that story to anybody that hasn't gotten a little bit of a tear in their eye thinking about what an important person Bob was in Courtney's life. And then people start reflecting on the best bosses that they've had in their life and what they meant to them.
So you just mentioned again that, you know, Bob met all that criteria that you had seen in your research. Tell me, what traits did you find that Bob had that was common with your research?
Well, you know, it started out with some characteristics that we saw throughout our study. There are a lot of characteristics that best bosses have, and Bob had these. He was authentic. He was compassionate. He was supportive. He really focused on Courtney, what she needed to grow and develop. He saw things in her that maybe she didn't even see in herself, and he made it his mission in his life to get the best out of Courtney, not only working, but as a person. I think maybe the most important part of that story is that, again, Bob saw potential in Courtney that she, as a young person right out of college, didn't have a chance, did not see in herself. And he, again, made it his mission to help her see that and then help her realize it. So those were some of the attributes that that Bob had that we saw throughout our best boss study. He activated her potential. He really made a focus on giving her feedback, both constructive criticism respectfully, but also giving her praise and recognition when it was deserved. He put her in situations when she was ready to make her own decisions. And he didn't. One of the biggest things that came through in our study is that people when they made mistakes, their bosses wouldn't hammer them for it. They would see that as a learning opportunity and almost encourage mistakes as long as you don't make too many of them, because that's the only way that you're going to learn and grow as a person.
I did enjoy very much the anecdote about the typo on a large mailer that was about to go out and how the boss reacted to that, you know, with understanding, recognizing it was a mistake, but not the, oh my God, the world's going to end. Having made mistakes during my career and been treated in a similar fashion, I can sort of attest to how sort of supportive that can be and how it can lead you to recognize, you know, that you can go on, make mistakes, and learn from it. The traits that you outlined sort of segue into the categories that you set forth of the categories of behavior common to best bosses. Let's elucidate those and talk about each of them as we go through them.
Sure. First of all, I'll just take a second to talk about the mistakes. That was those provided some of the best stories we heard from people. To a person, they would talk about when they made a mistake, they thought their boss was going to really kind of, you know, hit them hard, and the exact opposite happened. And they felt so relieved by it, as Courtney did in her story. It just made her want to do even more for Bob and bring out the best in her. So we did, through our study, we had all these responses. We analyzed every response that came through to us, and we saw patterns that were consistent across everybody's best boss experiences. And we saw five specific, what we call leadership themes or leadership dimensions. The first one is, and these aren't necessarily an order or a process, they're just the five dimensions. The first one is leading from a higher purpose, where the best boss would put the needs of the individual ahead of the organization or ahead of what the supervisor needed, that person's needs became paramount in terms of their working relationship. The second one was our term activating potential, that the boss made it their mission in life to not only help the person see their potential, but also to help them realize it. We had a lot of really great stories about people being forced out of their comfort zone and being a little bit scared and nervous and not sure about their abilities, but their boss believed in them enough to help them see that, put them in situations to do it, and then to, again, activate their potential. The third part, what we call, is pervasive feedback, and that's real-time feedback, honest, continuous, respectful feedback, both criticism, respectfully again, and also providing recognition. The fourth one we call promoting autonomy. That's putting in a position, a person in the position to be able to make their own decisions, but not doing it immediately. You lay the foundation with somebody to help them make their own decisions. You give them the right skills. You make sure that they understand the organization and the politics and the dynamics of the organization. You set clear expectations, and then you let the individuals go. And the fifth part is what we call continuous improvement. But this is tied, there's a connection between taking a risk, making a mistake, and continuous improvement. Those three things are all linked. That you won't take a risk if you think you're going to make a mistake, and you won't improve and grow and develop if really continuously improve if you're afraid to make a mistake. So those are the five dimensions or patterns we saw around leadership. None of those were particularly surprising to us, mm-hmm. because really when you think about great leadership, don't you think about development and feedback and values-based types of things from a leader? But what we saw was almost a system at work that every best boss had, that they understood that these five leadership dimensions integrated with each other. And you couldn't bring out the best in somebody unless they were using all five of these at their disposal. And that was one of the key learnings for us. We said, wow, these best bosses really kind of intuitively get all of these things naturally because their mission in their life is to help this person realize their potential.
And that's where I want to go next, because the first piece, or the first step really, was higher purpose. And the other ones really do fall and talk about, you know, direct interaction with the employee. But I want you to give... just talk about that higher purpose a little bit. You do reference servant leadership and Robert Greenlee's philosophy. I think it provides a why you do it. Can you walk the listeners through that?
Yeah, I can. You know, one of the kind of terms used these days in the world is it's not so much higher purpose, but values-based leadership. That the individual leader has a strong sense of values, a strong sense of purpose in their work. You even saw it in Courtney's story, that she learned so much from Bob in terms of how he conducted himself, his beliefs, his characteristics, his values, and that he was consistent and he was authentic and he was compassionate. Those are a key part of leading from a higher purpose. But one of the things that we saw, as I mentioned earlier, that these individuals, and when you're a leader in an organization, a boss, you're under a lot of pressure, because not only do you have a team of people that you're leading, you also have expectations from your bosses and for your role in the organization to continue to perform and push and drive. And these remarkable best bosses, these remarkable leaders, would consistently put the interest of a best of their direct reports ahead of their own needs or interests, or head of the organizations, because they knew that that's what they needed to do to help bring out the best and ultimately help that person perform. I included a story in the book from my early days working in corporate America, where my boss put me in a situation where I was in a really rough meeting with a bunch of union leaders that I wasn't quite ready for, and I got smacked around pretty good. And while he took some heat for that early on, because he sent me into this meeting that maybe I wasn't quite ready for, at the end of the day, when I left my job 3 years later, I was performing at a great level, and it was because he laid the foundation and helped me start out in a situation where I was able to start learning and growing myself as a person. So he put my needs as an individual in terms of growth and development ahead of his own needs, and I kind of caught up with him years later, and I said, what were you thinking, putting me into that meeting and letting me get in this... destroyed by the union leaders? And he said, you could do it, and you needed to start somewhere. So I had to put you there. You had to start learning sometime, and that was the time to do it.
It's interesting.
Does that help with that? Does that help with your question?
It does, and I think I'm looking at Allison. It's interesting, because you talk about putting the needs of the person ahead of the organization. I don't think that's completely true. I think what you're saying is more like you have to come up with a balance, and maybe there's a short term versus long term, because in the end, by making you a better employee, isn't he sort of helping the organization as well?
Yeah, that's probably put better than the way I described it, but I would agree that throughout our working lives, there's a struggle to find balance between what the organization needs and what my offer is, and certainly what my needs are and what the organization has to offer. And it's always those constant dynamics of trying to find that balance. And in this case, you're right. I mean, ultimately, the balance would level off, because in the early part of my tenure in that job that I described, things were out of balance because I wasn't able to deliver on what the organization needed. But through my boss seeing that we needed to find that balance and putting me in situations that I might not be able to contribute to right then, at the end of the day, it all worked out and the balance kind of shifted back.
And that sort of segues into the second factor, which is those tactics really were key to activating your potential, weren't they?
Yeah, they really are. You know, the activating potential was interesting. That was the most mentioned attribute in the study that we did from the responses, that activating somebody's potential was most prevalent in the relationship. And, you know, you don't just activate somebody's potential on their own. As you said, this is connected to every one of the other elements of the leadership dimensions. In fact, in each chapter, when we talk about the leadership dimensions, we talk about how the interplay is between each dimension. So if you're going to activate somebody's potential, you need to start off from a place to say, I'm going to help this person see their potential, and I'm going to start bringing out in them, because I can put their needs, at least on balance, in your words, with what the organization needs. You can't activate and develop somebody without great feedback. Again, not only recognition, but also criticism and constructive criticism, and doing it in real time. That's the word pervasive. It's all in real time. You can't activate somebody's potential unless you put them in a situation to make their own decisions, right? There's no way that you're going to be able to step up and start to kind of grow and develop without that. And then the last part around risk-taking mistakes, we talked about a little bit, that really to be able to develop and grow, as you mentioned earlier, we all make mistakes in our jobs. That's how you learn and grow. Everybody does that. And if you're afraid to make a mistake, you're not going to be able to grow as much. So certainly all four of the other leadership dimensions interplay with activating potential.
I want to go into the how you can promote autonomy, because you talk about, you know, unless someone can make their own decisions, only then can they, you know, learn. So how do you build that autonomy? Because a lot of people are concerned about, you know, well, are they going to do it my way? Are they going to, you know, get it done in the way that I've promised people is going to get done? And so a lot of tendency for managers is to micromanage. How do you break that?
Oh, yeah, you know, and that is true. There's a lot of reasons that managers micromanage. And it, you know, it does come back again, leading from a higher purpose and going back to my story. If the manager, Joe, in this case, wasn't willing to put me in a situation to be able to learn and grow, even though I was going to screw up a little bit, I was never going to kind of go forward. So that is an issue. Micromanaging, sometimes that's about trust or control with managers, or worrying about themselves getting kind of hit hard because somebody's going to mess up. And so you have to figure out how to manage that on your own. But I will say that, you know, when you talk about autonomy, sometimes people think right away to saying, you know, this, my boss is just going to leave me alone and let me make my own decisions. That's wrong, and that's not the right thing to do. I actually had that happen to me a couple times in my role as a leader, where I put somebody in a situation thinking that of course they want to be autonomous, just let them go. And I realized that there were certain things I didn't do to help them be successful. So, you know, back to your question, first and foremost, you have to make sure that you built certain skills and competencies in the person to be able to make their own decisions. You have to give them a really good sense of the organization and what the organization's expectations are, the strategy, some of the organizational dynamics, politics, all that kind of good stuff. You've got to be clear on, make sure it's clear to the individual what's going on there. And maybe most important, you have to set clear expectations. If I'm going to have you go manage this project that I could manage easier myself, I'm going to have to make sure that it's really clear on what's expected from that project and what needs to be delivered. And so oftentimes I see that that sometimes leaders don't set really good, clear expectations. They don't hold people accountable. Maybe they don't put a person in a situation to be able to actualize their skills and do that. Oftentimes, in these crazy days of business and work, the supervisor just doesn't have enough time or doesn't devote enough time to the person to allow them to be autonomous and make their own decisions. There was one quick story I'll tell you. A friend of mine was telling me about his best boss. He goes, I never had a chance to see him. I rarely had a chance to talk with him much. But any time I would ask him for 15 minutes, he would give me 15 minutes. He would close the door. He would turn his phone off. He'd turn his computer off. And while it was only 15 minutes, that 15 minutes was fully mine, and I knew that I had his full attention. And just little things like that can make a huge difference if you're going to be pushed out in the world to make your own decisions, that you know that person's there for you when you need them, and they're going to help you. They're going to be supportive and help you. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Sure.
Can we touch on, we're running out of time, but I do want to touch on the difference between pervasive feedback and criticism, because the story you just told about making time to talk to you is one element of feedback. Can you sort of broaden that out a little bit?
Yeah, sure. You know, one of the things about feedback, and I mentioned it just a little while ago, is that this feedback that we saw from best bosses was almost in real time. It was just a natural part of a relationship. So it wasn't a scheduled quarterly performance management review or whatever. It would happen in real time. Maybe 10 minutes after you made a presentation, your boss was giving you some thoughts about how you did. And the really key word here is within criticism is respectful criticism. We heard a lot from people that said that they would receive criticism, it would be constructive, and it would always be respectful and in real time. So oftentimes people get criticism, but it's not very respectful. You dummy, you just didn't do it right. People get yelled at, all that kind of good stuff, right? And just think about that for a second. I mean, I watch that, I see it in sports all the time where guys are just getting yelled at on the sidelines. I'm thinking, really, that's how you're going to bring out the best in somebody? Anyway, those two words, constructive and respectful, are really critical. The criticism needs to be tied to what went wrong or where they need to improve, as opposed to attacking their personhood, for sure. But again, you talked about criticism, but it's just equally important to provide recognition for good work, because that's how you learn and grow too. I take a hard look at the Gallup studies that come out all the time, and it's shocking how many people don't get recognition on a regular basis in their job. It's just amazing.
Well, we've been speaking with Duncan Ferguson. He is the author of Best Boss, The Impact of Extraordinary Leaders. We've appreciated the time you've spent with us this morning, Duncan.
The 40-hour or more work week that spans 5 days has become an established aspect of society. Out of 7 days, we work five and we take two off, and that's always been the case, right? In fact, the five-day work week began the norm only after Henry Ford established it in his factories in May 1926. The seven-day week or the five-day week work are both kind of arbitrary and changeable. And so is how we run our businesses. It's the way it is, for almost no good reason. It is how it is because it is how it has been.
According to Joe Sanek, a licensed counselor, entrepreneur, and seasoned podcaster, there is another way. In his new book, Thursday is the New Friday, How to Work Fewer Hours, Make More Money, and Spend Time Doing What You Want, Sanek argues that the traditional five-day work week, with its deep historical roots and strong reinforcement from the bygone industrial era, is no longer serving us well. Further, he points to study after study, including one that spanned 32 years, that shows working more increases our risk of chronic disease. Joe, thank you for joining us this morning on Mountain Money.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to talk about, let's start with the history of the five-day work week, because I think, I didn't know necessarily where it came from until I started looking through your book, but, where did it come from and what influenced it?
Yeah, so one of the major influences of it was how people were working in the late 1800s. So the average person in the late 1800s was working 10 to 14 hours a day, 6 to 7 days a week. And so they had a farmer's schedule. even if they weren't farmers. There was actually major protests in Chicago after and during the rebuilding of Chicago after the fire, where numerous Europeans had moved over for a better life and actually found that their life was worse off than how it had been in Europe. And so we see this happening in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And then Henry Ford in 1926, in an effort to sell more cars to his own employees, switches over to the 40-hour work week. And his goal really was that his own employees, if they were given a weekend, that they would buy a car. They wouldn't come to work faster in a car, but they would get it so they could maximize their weekends. And it worked, and it really took off. So this thing that we think is so solid is actually less than 100 years old.
So it is a baseline, certainly, of modern American life. I think your argument is that it just doesn't have to be that way. And what is it that you think could be better and why?
Yeah, if we actually look at the studies, when we look at productivity in the 80s and 90s in regards to Fridays, we see that Fridays really do start to slip into more of the weekend. The amount of work people get done on Fridays slips more and more. We see the rise of casual Fridays. It's when people start hosting wedding showers and baby showers at work, and they do cheesy team building activities, and they're planning out their weekend on Fridays. And we see that study after study is now showing that actually that last 8 hours of, quote, productivity is actually detrimental to the productivity. Iceland just a couple of months ago released a study that was a multi-year study of over 2,500 people in multiple disciplines. So it wasn't just bus drivers or teachers or doctors. It was across numerous disciplines. And they actually found that those that worked a 32-hour, four-day week were more productive than those that worked a 40-hour week. And so we see that those last 8 hours actually moves the needle backward in most situations.
Sorry, I was pausing because I'm thinking. So, you know, when I went through the book, you know, you talk about evaluating, understanding, and growing your curiosity, and this will help speed your success towards a shorter work week. So again, you know, how can I start to change this, and how does curiosity become a part of this?
Yeah, so at the core of this, when we look at how the industrialists used to teach us and still do, is they give us a prescription that they say, here's the 5 steps for more productivity. And it's very linear. You're either in or you're out. And the new way of writing books and learning is to view it more as a menu and to do experiments to see what works. And so for some people, it may not be realistic to just jump to a four-day work week. But if we start first internally, we look at our internal inclinations, and that curiosity is one of those 3 internal inclinations that we see being top for being able to move forward. Then we move into slowing down. So we're optimizing our brain so that we genuinely slow down. And then when we go work, we actually use the neuroscience to get more done during that 4 days or whatever period of time someone's moving towards. And so when we start with curiosity, we start with the posture towards our business and towards our life that we don't know it all. I have 2 daughters that are 7 and 10, and they ask a million questions all the time. They're trying to figure out, is this normal or is this something that's an outlier? So the first time they see a rainbow, the first time they see a car accident, the first time they see anything, they're trying to sort out, is this a normal part of the human experience, or is this actually something that's outside of the typical norm? And as adults, we oftentimes think that we have it all figured out. But top leaders actually approach most of their business with a spirit of curiosity. So say they do a mega Facebook ads campaign and it's not as successful as they had anticipated it to be. They see that as data to say, okay, we learned about our audience. We learned about what doesn't work with them. We learned about the copy that doesn't work, the images that doesn't work. And they view each of those things as an experiment. And so when we go into both our life and business with an experimental mindset or an evolutionary mindset, that then allows us to level up differently than if we just take that old industrialist mindset.
You focus on intuition and talk a lot about how our body processes more advanced data points than we are conscious of. Can you sort of flesh that out a little bit and talk a little bit about how you even make reference to the Ricky Gervais, who noted this. Can you talk a little bit about that for us?
Yeah, Ricky Gervais has a line that I'm not going to get exactly right, but he talks about how the toupees, we intuitively know when a toupee walks into the room. It's like our body has spidey senses to just know that a toupee walked into the room. And really,
bald assertion.
When we think about, oh, well played, sir. So when we look at intuition research, it's really interesting to see how executives that value that as part of the equation actually statistically end up getting more done and having more effective teams. And so when we look at our typical five senses, we know that there's actually the research is emerging to show that we have multiple other senses that we aren't necessarily naming in the same way, but we would say is more intuition. And so when we're having that be part of the equation, not necessarily all of it, then it allows us to get more done and to be able to see things differently than if we only relied on the pure facts in front of us.
So it's back to the, I know the answer. Hold on, Roger may have something. No, okay. it's back to most of us go through life saying, well, I know the answer. And one of the pieces in the book, you talk about science fiction writer Isaac Asimov, and say he had said the most exciting phrase to hear in science, the one that heralds new discoveries, is not eureka, but that's funny. So, why is that a good way to approach a situation? And why is that a good answer?
Yeah, I think most of how we live our lives as adults is reactionary rather than intentional. And that's a big shift for a lot of people to say, I'm entering into this future weekend to be intentional about letting my brain recuperate and have fun and enjoy it versus being reactionary to what maybe we think society wants us to do, which might be running to soccer practice and hosting a potluck and making sure everything is done in our house. But to actually step back and say, okay, what is it intentionally that I want to have happen here? And that quote that you said is doing that exact thing, where we're looking at life as saying, well, that's interesting when things unfold in front of us, and then we're better able to make different decisions with that intentionality rather than just being reactionary to everything that's around us. Because many of us just don't take that time to say, what do I want this to look like in my life, in my business, in my money, in my kids? All those things are really important for us to say, what is that intentionality that we want to have moving forward into those aspects of life?
Hmm. Well, following up on the theme we introduced with toupees, can you talk a little bit about the outsider approach and your experience with hair dye?
Yeah, so one of the top internal inclinations that the research has exposed that top leaders have is an outsider approach. And we see people like Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, Albert Einstein, that put themselves intentionally into unique situations where they were outsiders. And a lot of their connections then kind of came together in that. And so since you bring up the hair dye, throughout college, I liked to try different ways of having my hair. And so I had applied for this job at a runaway shelter and hadn't heard from them for a long period of time and thought it was safe to dye my hair. So I dyed it all blonde and then did a cheetah print with little Q-tips of black. And wouldn't you know, the next day I get a phone call for an interview. And so I'm in this interview and the two people are interviewing me and they're looking at the top of my head the entire time. And I just want to say my eyes are down here, folks. But I end up getting the job, and they actually said that this leopard print hair was a selling point to them because they needed someone that could connect with these kids that wanted to run away from home. And so often we think that we just have to conform and jump into a business and not ask questions. But anytime any of us have joined a new business or a new job, there's always that onboarding phase where you're learning the different systems. But usually there's a point where you start to understand the systems and you say to yourself, that's kind of weird how they do it that way. Why do they do it that way? This seems like a more efficient way. Actually, as an outsider, you have more influence than you really believe. There was a study that was done. It was between the colors blue and green, and they would bring together groups of 6 to 8 people. And they show these colors that were somewhat in the middle between blue and green. And they say, is this blue or is this green? And this group would say for the most part, blue and green, they'd agree. But then the second part of the study, they brought in two outsiders with different groups. And those outsiders for certain colors would push blue when it was green or green when it was blue. And they found that statistically, those outsiders actually had more influence inside that group than the insiders had. And so we see study after study reveal that outsiders and keeping that outsider perspective is actually one of the top things that we can do internally to be effective in our leadership and our approach to life.
So again, this book takes us to the, Thursday is the new Friday, which means that all of these pieces go into helping make your work week shorter. How does that happen?
Yeah, so there's kind of two different factors. So on one side, we have people that are working at a typical 40-hour a week plus job, and they're an employee. So it's more of advocating and working with a team to work with your supervisor to do different types of experiments to test out the 4-day work week. I have an article in Harvard Business Review this month that walks through the exact kind of formula for working with your boss around how to request that. We can talk about aspects of that if you want. And then on the other side, we have the entrepreneurs. And for the average entrepreneur, those folks often are doing work that they enjoy. Maybe they're not doing all the work that they enjoy, but for the most part, they have some autonomy. And so the level of creativity and ideas and boundaries that they need to set around their own schedule, that's their biggest challenge. And so when we see people that first enter into their internal work, then they move into the slowing down, and then they move into the speeding up, we see that people can actually get a lot more done if they use the neuroscience to help them. So one example is the University of Illinois did a research study on vigilance decrement. So vigilance, how well you pay attention to something, decrement meaning that it goes down over time. And so the leading idea was that you're doing a really boring task and you experience vigilance decrement, that at the end of that task, you do a worse job than at the beginning of that task. So the study actually found that if every 20 minutes, you take a 1-minute break, it completely eliminates vigilance decrement, meaning that with these very boring tasks that they gave the subjects of the study, they actually had the same level of attention at the end of it than at the beginning. And so why is that? Well, the brain is still really old. And so the way it's evolved is it wants to keep us safe. And so if we leave an environment in the middle of a boring task and then we return back in, if we disengage and re-engage, the brain thinks it's a new environment. It needs to pay attention for safety measures and all of those different things. So then it engages differently than if we just sit and do a boring task for an hour straight.
One of the other, I don't know if it's a symptom or a cause or what it is, but, and I can't remember the name, but it's your work will take as long as you give it.
Yeah, so Parkinson's law says that work will expand to the time given. And so, I mean, I think back to when I was in college, if I saw on my schedule that I had a paper due the next day I hadn't planned for, I got that paper done in one night. Whereas if I know I have 2 or 3 weeks to do it, it takes 2 or 3 weeks to do that. And so oftentimes what we're competing against is on one side we have accuracy, and on the other side of the spectrum, we have speed. And you know, there's things we want to be accurate. If I go in for surgery, I want my doctor, I want her to do as great of a job as she can do, take as long as you want. I want the pilot in an airplane to land it accurately. But in business and in most of life, speed trumps accuracy almost every time, because then we get those iterations, we get feedback from our customers, we're able to learn and adapt quicker. And instead of being paralyzed by perfection, we then get more done.
Before we go, and we're running out of time, I want to talk a little bit about how you believe that this kind of a slowing down will lead to an increase in happiness. Because at the end of the day, that's pretty much what this is all about. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, there was a workplace study that was done in the middle of COVID-19 between March and June of 2020, looking at happiness then compared to happiness the years before. And happiness actually peaked in the middle of the pandemic. And a lot of the factors as to why was that people had significantly more autonomy in their schedule. They had significantly more time with their family. And when I look ahead, when I think of us as the post-pandemic generation, the people that have lived through one of the most disruptive things in our human history, we have a window of time right now that we can say we're going to go back to how it was. 2019 is the best we can do with our health outcomes and our happiness outcomes. Or we can say we can do better than that. We can think differently. We can change things. We don't have to go back to the industrialist model. When I think about the next 30 to 50 years of challenges that society is going to have with global warming, global poverty, potentially more pandemics, significant challenges are ahead of us. And do we want our generation to be burned out and stressed out? Or do we want them to be the most creative and productive that they can be? And to me, the next step of our human evolution and our business evolution is to take that step into the 4-day work week. In the same way that in 1926, it was a huge step forward when Henry Ford gave us the 40-hour work week, moving away from those 10 to 14-hour days. Right now, we have that window as a society to ask these questions and say, is 2019 the best we can do? Or can we move forward and to create something better?
We really appreciate your time. We have had the opportunity to speak with author Joe Sonek. He is the author of Thursday is the New Friday, How to Work Fewer Hours, Make More Money, and Spend Time Doing What You Want. Joe, thank you for spending time with Mountain Money today. The Biden administration has announced a number of tax proposals to fund new government investments such as infrastructure, education, and family programs as part of the Build Back Better agenda. Joining us this morning is Joe Hillstead, partner at Squire & Company, to help us understand these impacts. Joe, thanks for joining us this morning.
Great to be with you.
So what industries would the tax hikes target, and would this affect businesses of all sizes in these categories?
Yeah, that's a great question. And just to give you a little bit of context about that, you know, as you know, the Biden administration announced plans to pursue, two major pieces of legislation this year. You know, you mentioned the Infrastructure Act, which is, has passed the Senate, still pending in the House. The second piece of legislation, involves social and educational spending and is tentatively called the Build Back Better Act. And this is the act that includes, major tax changes. And in terms of industries that will be affected, well, let's talk about all industries that will be affected first. The corporate tax rate under the Build Back Better Act is proposed to go from a flat 21% corporate tax rate to a progressive rate that would start at 18% for corporations that have taxable income under $400,000. And then for corporations with taxable income over $400,000, it would jump up to 21% until $5 million. And then anything over $5 million would go up to 26.5%. And this is a compromise. Under the Biden campaign, he proposed a flat 28%. And so that, that's going to affect, most corporations that are, or most businesses that are organized as C corporations. So let's talk about some of the industries that will be affected. Well, real estate in this, fortunately, the like-kind exchange provisions under Section 1031 will not be affected. So the real estate industry, they breathe a sigh of relief on that one. Manufacturing, right now, manufacturers and other pass-through entities that get a deduction, a 20% deduction for their income, there's going to be some limitations that will be imposed on that, and that will be for certain taxpayers that make over $400,000. And that seems to be the magic number here for this Build Back Better Act, is that the administration and Congress is trying to target individuals making $400,000, and so that's where individuals are going to be hit by that. There's going to private equity will be hit, real estate, those that have carried interest, things like that. So those are some of the industries. In addition to the pharmaceutical industry related to prices, there'll be some unfavorable tax things that will happen to them.
Let me ask two questions. One is just going back to context. The status of the bill we're talking about, is this the draft that currently exists that you're referring to that tells us what these provisions are?
Yeah, that's right. So it's the Build Back Better Act is for lack of a better term, is in piecemeal parts in committee, and the House Ways and Means Committee, which is the committee that originates tax legislation, is the one that has put forward this draft legislation, and that draft legislation is now, from what I understand, and I'm no parliamentarian, but is in the budget reconciliation process right now.
And the second thing that I wanted to ask you is, you referred to private equity. For years, one of the more controversial aspects of the tax code has been the positive treatment of what's called carried interest. Can you talk a little bit about what that is, why it's so controversial, and what the bill does with it?
Yeah, you bet. So carried interest is exactly right, controversial. Congress has been trying to target it for years. And essentially, when a general partner in a partnership, say private equity, for example, that is providing services on behalf of its investments, its portfolio companies, for example, that is commonly called carried interest. And that carried interest has been subject to lower preferential capital gains rates. So instead of being taxed at the high ordinary income rates, which right now is 37%, that carried interest is taxed at the lower preferential rates, 15% or 20%, depending on where your income lies. In the past, you know, certain candidates were criticized because they had, you know, carried interest, which reduced their effective tax rate lower than, you know, others, for example. So, current law is that in order to get capital gain treatment, you have to hold that interest for 3 years. The Build Back Better Act says, no, that needs to be 5 years. So they're expanding that you need to hold that for 5 years instead of three in order to get that capital gain treatment.
What kind of other significant impacts are you seeing as you look through the draft bill?
Other significant impacts. Well, the biggest one is that the increase in the top individual marginal rate goes from 37% to 39.6%. Further, you know, right now under current law, an individual who's married and files a joint return doesn't hit that 37% tax bracket until their taxable income is north of $620,000-ish. So what would happen is now that 39.6 would kick in when individuals, you know, who file a joint return hit 450,000. If you're single, 400,000. Additionally, there's a 3% surcharge that would be applicable to really high income earners. So those that have gross income more than $5 million, there's a 3%, surcharge there. There is an additional 3.8% net investment tax that is broadened. There's currently, that provision still exists for passive type of income for certain high earners, but that would be broadened to include active business instead of passive type of investment income.
Let's talk about stepped up basis, which is something that is often discussed by politicians as being, and it is somewhat controversial. What does it mean and what do they propose to do with it?
Yeah, great question. So, right now under current tax law, if someone passes away and they pass an asset to their heirs take a stepped up basis. So, if my grandmother passed away and she had Apple stock, that stock would go to me and my basis in that stock is fair market value, what it is today. I could immediately turn around, sell that Apple stock and have no taxable gain or loss because I just sold it for its fair market value. So it wouldn't be taxable to me in that situation. So under the Biden campaign, the proposal was to eliminate that. But interestingly enough, in the BBBA, that provision is not in the House Ways and Means Committee draft, which is interesting. I think it's also interesting to note on that same topic that right now there is a lifetime gift and estate exclusion of $11.7 million, meaning you can transfer in life through a gift or in death through transferring it to your heirs $11.7 million without incurring any gift or estate tax. The current proposal and up to Congress is that will be reduced from the $11.7 million to $5 million plus some inflation adjustments. So with those adjustments, it's actually around $6 million there.
It's an interesting point because in the past, a lot of times I've heard that the big problem with stepped-up basis is that it allows that gain never to be taxed. But as I understand, and I think what you just said is, that would be true. Your grandmother's Apple stock, you could sell it without paying any capital gains tax. But to the extent that your grandmother was wise enough to have Apple stock that was worth more than $11 million, it would get taxed at fair market value as part of the estate tax, wouldn't it?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, exactly. So if her stock and other assets exceeded that $11.7 million, then that would be subject to the estate tax. And right now, let's say that her estate was it was $20 million.
You should be so lucky.
Yeah, right, right. So that the amount, the $20 million in excess of the 11.7 would be taxed right now at 40%. You know, there's been proposals to increase that to 45%. But again, that 11.7 would be ratcheted down to, you know, about 6 million when you take into account the inflation adjustment that Congress has.
I know that there's a ton on the plate that we could be talking about and that we only have a little bit of time left. And what I wanted to do is just talk about, you know, part of Biden's plan is to reverse years of underfunding of the IRS, which reduced auditing and enforcement efforts. Do you have any advice? If I haven't been up to any nefarious activity, do I need to worry?
Yeah. I think the answer to that is yes. And just like you mentioned, so the bill provides $80 billion of additional funding to the IRS. And all the commentators are saying that folks that don't make more than $400,000 really don't have to worry. And so the enforcement efforts, you know, should be focused on those high income earners and large corporations. You know, we like to say the IRS has bigger fish to fry than middle class folks that are making under that magic number that I talked about. We don't know much more than that. You know, where that's going to go, if that's hiring more revenue agents or increase in technology. We know that the IRS has really taken a hit due to COVID. It's been a struggle to get a hold of them. As our clients get notices, it's been difficult to get clarification from them. And so, we hope that those services become strengthened.
I want to thank you for joining us today. You know, this is a moving target, and I hope you'll consider coming back and talking to us again as this evolves.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.